thanks, Alan, for appearing today. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about energy productivity, which is, as you know, something dear to my heart, but also talk a little bit about energy-efficient buildings and low-carbon buildings, and also talk a little bit about the market, the electricity market. So that'll take an hour or two. So why don't we start off just, we're doing some interesting work at the moment, having a look at value chains and improving energy productivity. Be interested just to get your sense of the scale of the opportunity to improve the amount of value we get from using energy.
Well, energy productivity gives you two angles to make savings. One is by reducing the amount of energy you're using, and the second is by getting more value in product and service for each unit of energy. And I think that's one of its strengths, because that can appeal to a lot more business people and financial policy makers. So I think that's a strength. I think also the thing that I think is attractive in many ways about energy productivity is that when you put it on a graph and you're doing better, it goes upwards instead of downwards. Yeah. And I think politicians and I think the psychology of the masses is if it's going up, it must be good. Mm. So I think there's a deep psychology in energy productivity. But certainly in terms of what's possible, I think what we're finding is that very large improvements in energy productivity are possible, and clearly several organisations have come up with studies showing we could double our energy productivity in Australia by 2030. Mm. I think we could easily do much better than that. Mm. It's really about how hard you want to drive it. Yeah. And I think given the urgent need to get a climate policy that works, and the urgent need for politicians to limit the cost of energy for business and households, that we may well do a lot more energy productivity achievement than has been expected. And certainly the technologies are there. The technologies are not the issue. The issues are how to engage people in decision-making roles to make the right decisions and get on with it.
Well, given the fact that we're going to be on a website from a group of people that are interested in buildings, I might just ask you a little bit to link up with the energy productivity, some of the stuff that we're finding on the construction materials and the importance of embedded energy, and then I'll get on to operating buildings. So would you like to make any comments on the, on the importance of and the opportunities from better approaches to construction?
When people look at the life cycle impacts of building energy, I think it's certainly true historically that the operating energy has been the big issue.
Yep.
But what we're now finding is that as you achieve your 6-star neighbours rated building or your 9 or 10 star rated house, that the embodied energy in all the materials is starting to be pretty big, relatively.
Yep.
So I think we're moving with energy productivity is you do need to look at the life cycle, and you need to look at the value people are getting from a comfortable home that they like living in. So there's things like that. In terms of the technologies, I think we're already seeing amazing developments in materials to reduce embodied energy. For example, cross-laminated timber high-rise buildings, which I think they're up over 30 stories in some places now, are proving to be remarkable in what they can do. We still haven't even really touched on some of the things like fibre-reinforced concretes, which can get rid of the steel from the concrete, which is half the embodied energy of concrete. Mm. Likewise, we will start to see composite timber and carbon fibre and other materials blended together to produce amazingly light, amazingly thin and amazingly strong materials. In the same way, when we're looking at insulation materials, there's products called aerogels which have been used for premium purposes, but there's no reason why they need to be expensive, and they'll give you double the insulation performance per unit of thickness. Which means that in many places where you're limited for space, you'll be able to use these much better insulation products to achieve high performance and still have a compact thickness.
I was just in New York for Climate Week and saw some fantastic presentations from provincial premiers from Canada about, you know, the amazing things they were doing, and also California, which has just announced that it's ramping up, it's accelerating its carbon mitigation program. Mm-hmm. What do you think about our level of ambition in terms of the built environment, where you've got California by 2020 wanting to have all net zero emission residential buildings, and by 2025, I think those are the right dates anyhow, all net zero commercial buildings. How does that line up with our building codes currently?
Yeah, well, if we look at building codes and building objectives in Australia, I think what's fascinating is the enormous difference between the commercial sector, the non-residential, and the residential. I think the commercial sector is heading in a very positive direction. Neighbours have had to add the sixth star, and now people are getting that a bit too easily, so we'll hear.
Is that flowing though to the sort of the other than premium buildings?
Well, there's certainly evidence to show that the premium buildings are the ones that have really performed. Yeah. But I think Sustainability Victoria have recently done some very interesting work with what they call the mid-tier buildings, and delivering, you know, 30% savings with, you know, 30% internal rate of return. What I think has been interesting is that in the project they did, some of the building managers and owners have really been so excited by the benefits they've gained in terms of actually being able to rent space out or rent it more at a higher price, or in one case, the building manager was able to reduce his response time on maintenance problems from 3 days to 3 hours. So he's got happy people in his building for the first time forever, by the sound of it. So I think that it's been slow, and of course we should and could have done far better far sooner. But the other side of it is we've now got so many mature technologies whose costs are coming down, and people who know how to apply them in that sector. I think that's a really strong one. I think the big problem we've got is in residential, where unfortunately the polarisation between some of the building industries and the, if you like, the progressive position is worse now than when I project managed the introduction of the first building energy regulations in 1991. It's a serious cultural problem, which I think is partly because we have overemphasised regulation at the expense of incentive, and governments have failed to engage with home buyers effectively for them to ask for these things. Even though they want them, they don't ask for them. And there are even very basic issues. For example, we should have rescaled the star rating scheme when we went up with stringency. Yep. Because the problem we have is that a salesperson in a house, when someone says, oh, I'd like an energy efficient house, can say, oh, but this is a six star house, it's fantastic. Yeah. And it's like, it's rubbish, but he is able to say it's a six-star house. And the person historically says, well, gee, a five-star hotel is really good. This is a six-star house. It must be fantastic. Okay, let's talk about the granite benchtop. Yeah. You know, and so I think we have a really deep cultural divide on residential, and we really have to fix it. And it's going to take very strong action and a lot of investment of money by governments to change the culture. And I think we're going to have to do things like structure the first home buyers grants so that you only get them if you're building a really efficient house that's not too big. And the building industry will respond to that, because that first home buyers grant is a key element of someone getting a deposit. So that's the sale, that's the link. I think also, again, we see in the commercial sector where we've got mandatory disclosure of energy at resale, which is a big driver of new buildings as well. Mm. In the residential sector, we've been trying since 2004, and it still has not happened. Yep. So these are really deep. Mm. There's something wrong culturally in here amongst the decision makers on residential.
Now, just to ask you a couple of questions on the electricity market. I'll ask you the same question that I asked Craig. How do you feel, and it's a bit of a Dorothy Dixer really, but I'll ask it anyhow. How do you feel that the market has worked for the benefit of the consumer over the last 10 years?
It hasn't. We've got really expensive electricity and very little empowerment. It's been a total failure. But the issue for me is that they set it up wrongly in the 90s. Yeah. And all it's the big interesting thing for me is it's taken so long for it to become obvious to a lot of people what a mess it is. Yeah. So that's a really big issue at the moment. And you know, it's bizarre that we are having to have what is essentially a war between emerging technologies and the combination of the policymakers, the regulators, and the incumbent industry. This is really wrong.
Yeah, and how do you feel about the role of demand management in all of this? And, you know, I'm just watching the South Australian situation with interest, and that no one ever seemed to mention demand management as part of the mix.
Yeah. Well, the role of demand management has massively been underplayed in the whole energy market. And if you look at the historical context, you know, in the early 90s, there was a whole discussion about how to incorporate demand management into the electricity market. And in the end, the powerful incumbent groups decided they didn't want to do it. So we actually had a process and lost. You then go to 2002, where Warwick Pearer, the former Howard Energy Minister, did a review and concluded that the demand side was not working and that the demand side had to be made to work if the energy market was to deliver.
Yeah, yeah.
That's 2002. 14 years later, it's still not delivering.
Yeah.
And we have the situation where COAG's Energy Council and AEMC have failed to deliver quite specific demand-side bidding proposals that are clearly in the public interest but are not in the interests of the incumbents.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the track record's there.
Yeah, yeah. I was involved in 2009 putting in a submission to the AER on the New South Wales undertaking, and they spent, out of that that discussion, they spent $9 billion on supply side and gave $4 million for a learning by doing fund for demand management.
Oh, and it's just appalling. And, you know, and what we now see is that the energy sector is using high fixed supply charges to disempower consumers and to shore up the stability of their revenue streams. I do not understand how a regulator can allow that to happen, because that is a massive distortion of the market.
How do you feel, and this is a bit of an inflammatory question, how do you feel about the accountability of the regulators, given the fact that we've ended up with a market outcome that's been very poor for consumers, and a lot of the incumbent regulators are still doing the same job as they were leading these organisations?
I feel a bit sorry for the regulators, because again, if you look at the history, when the market was being set up, there was a conscious philosophy of what they call light-handed regulation.
Yeah, true.
And so the regulatory frameworks were deliberately set up to be weak and under-resourced and to fail.
Yeah, keep your hands off.
And the issue that we face is that we can see that I actually compare it a bit to parenting. You know, if you're a weak and uncertain, confused parent, your kids start taking advantage of you and push the boundaries all the time, and your parenting gets harder. Well, in the same way, when you've got a weak regulator, and when most of the profits are available near the boundaries of the law, you've created a situation where the participants in the market have a strong incentive to essentially push the boundaries and challenge everything the regulator does. So we now see, you know, thousands of pages and millions of dollars every time the regulator brings in a policy, a decision, it's challenged, and most of the time it's actually overruled.
Yep.
Now, this is even after they've strengthened the regulator's powers.
Yep.
There's something really wrong in this system.
And just a question about the national electricity objective. Mm. I mean, should carbon mitigation be part of the national electricity objective?
Well, of course. And in fact, again, if you go back to the early 90s, the original draft of the national electricity objective had climate and environment built into it.
Yep.
And again, a conscious decision was made by the powerful incumbent groups to remove that.
Yep.
And to focus on what they call this economic objective. And in fact, what's interesting, I think, is that the Productivity Commission, in its recent report, emphasised that the focus of the objective should be on the long-term interests of consumers, which clearly has to include climate,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And yet, the AEMC continues to talk about being an economic regulator and focusing on a very narrow definition of its role.
Yep.
Again, there's something seriously wrong here.
Yep. So I've made the last people king and queen for the day. So in this interview, I'll make you the emperor for the day. So if you were the emperor, what would you do as the three key things to improve the opportunities for energy efficiency and energy productivity?
Well, of course, this emperor has no clothes, so we need to keep this in mind. I think we're emerging into a very real, competitive, diverse marketplace of a kind that no one in the energy sector has ever experienced. And I think we need to bring, you know, marketing people from other industries into energy to start reframing things. I think very clearly we have to regulate the structures of tariffs so that no company can charge high fixed charges and no big declining tariffs, which we were doing, of course, in the 1980s. So that's a key point. I think the other issue is that if I want to sell electricity to someone within, say, 500 metres of my property, I should be allowed to do that based on a benchmark cost of what it would cost me to run a long lead to to their house. There's a really big problem here with the fundamentals of the way that the system works. I think also we need very strong incentives built into energy pricing and into other structures, as I said a while ago, on first home buyer incentives and things like that. We need strong incentives that drive the demand side. And I think a few years ago, one of the California people was talking about how their incentive for the demand side investment by energy companies doesn't just increase if you do more than you're meant to, it increases exponentially. And that's the kind of incentive that makes business people interested in mobilizing, not just complying.
Well, thank you very much, Alan. As the only other person that I know in the energy efficiency industry that's been in the business as long as I have, and a co-worker, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.